For a person flying past in a high-speed rocket, the distance x in space and the distance t in time will change. But if s is to remain the same, then the event must still lie somewhere on the circle. So different observers record different positions in space and time separately for the same event, but subject to the constraint that we only slide the point around on the circle. Now, something very dramatic can happen. We can slide event A all the way around the circle so that it lies somewhere on the lower half of the circle. That means that according to some other observer, event A could occur before event O. This is a world where you finish your breakfast before you wake up. Such a circumstance is a clear violation of our cherished axiom of causality. We have discovered that the requirement of causality is intimately related to the way that we define the distance in space-time, and the simple Pythagorean definition with the plus sign is no good. We are faced with what the English biologist Thomas Henry Huxley famously described as the great tragedy of science, the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact. Huxley, known as Darwin's bulldog for his sterling defence of evolution, was once asked by William Wilberforce whether it was from his grandfather or grandmother that he claimed his descent from a monkey. Huxley is said to have replied that he would not be ashamed to have a monkey for his ancestor, but he would be ashamed to be connected with a man who used his great gifts to obscure the truth. The tragic truth in our case is that we must reject the simplest hypothesis if we are to preserve causality and move on to something a little more complicated. Our next, and in fact only remaining hypothesis, is that the distance between points in space-time is to be calculated using s squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared. In contrast to the plus sign version, this is a world where Euclidean geometry does not apply, as in the case of geometry on the surface of the Earth. Mathematicians have a name for a space in which the distance between two points is governed by this equation. It is called hyperbolic space. Physicists have a different name for it. They call it Minkowski space-time. The listener might take this to be a clue that we are on the right track. Our top priority must be to establish whether Minkowski space-time violates the demands of causality. To answer this question, we need once again to take a look at the lines in space-time that lie a constant distance s from O. That is, we want to consider the analogue of the circles in Euclidean space-time. The minus sign makes all the difference. Let's start with the same old events, O and A. All points in space-time that lie the same distance from O as A does no longer lie on a circle centred on O. Instead, they lie on a curve known to mathematicians as a hyperbola. Mathematically speaking, all the points on the curve satisfy our distance equation, i.e. s squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared. The curve has the crucial property that it never crosses from O's past into O's future, unlike the circle. Now, the situation as viewed by observers in rocket ships is completely different from the plus sign version because event A always stays in the future of event O. We can slide A around, but never into O's past. In other words, everyone agrees that we wake up before we finish our breakfast. We can breathe a sigh of relief. Causality is not violated in Minkowski space-time. It's worth repeating this, because it is one of the most important points in the book. If we decide to define the distance in space-time between the two events O and A using Pythagoras's equation, but with a minus sign, then no matter how anyone views the two events, A never crosses into O's past. This means that if event A is in O's future according to one observer, then every other observer will also agree that A is in O's future too. Because the hyperbola never ever crosses into O's past, everyone agrees that eating breakfast comes after waking up. We've just completed a subtle piece of reasoning. It certainly does not mean that we are correct in our original hypothesis that there should be an invariant distance in space-time that is agreed upon by all observers. What it does mean, though, is that our hypothesis has survived an important test. It has survived the demands of the requirement of causality. We are not finished, however, because we are not just playing around with mathematics, we are physicists, and we are trying to construct a theory that describes how the world works. The ultimate and decisive test of our theory will be whether it can produce predictions that agree with experiment, and we are not yet ready to make a prediction because we don't know what the calibrating speed C is. Without a number, we simply can't do the sums. Remember, we needed C in order to have any chance of defining the notion of distance in space-time, because we had to measure space and time in the same currency. But so far, we have no idea what it actually represents. Is it the speed of anything interesting? The key to the answer lies in an intriguing property of the Minkowski space-time we have just constructed. The hyperbolic curve on which A lies has one further important property. The curve sits entirely in a region sandwiched between two 45-degree lines heading out from O. Those lines at 45 degrees are important for the following reason. Apart from curves like the one containing A, there are other curves of constant space-time distance from O that do cross from O's future to O's past. They lie outside the region in which the curve containing A is sandwiched. An example of an event lying on such a curve would be one that occurred simultaneously with O, that is, at the same time as the waking up event. For such an event, different observers would determine that the event is no longer simultaneous with O, and worse still, depending on how they are moving, the event could lie either in O's past or in O's future. This is a little bit worrying, because these curves switch past and future, just as happened in the Pythagorean version of the equation. In that case, this led us to reject the hypothesis because it meant that causality was violated. Are we in the same boat with the minus sign version of hyperbolic space-time? Are we sunk? Well, no, there is a way out. Let us imagine an event B sitting in the troubling region. For this event, it is possible for some observers to consider event B as occurring in O's future, while for others, it is in O's past. Don't forget, every observer must agree on the space-time distance between events, even if they do not agree on the distances in space and time separately, and that means we can slide B around on the curve of constant space-time distance from O. It looks like a breakdown of causality, but fortunately, that is very definitely not the case. How are we to restore causality to our theory of space-time? To answer this question, we need to think a little more carefully about what we mean by causality. This next piece will involve rocket ships and lasers, so if the abstract reasoning of the previous sections has left you drained, then you can relax for a while. Let's think about event O again, waking up in bed in the morning. To be a little more precise, the event could correspond to my alarm clock going off. Shortly beforehand, on a planet in the Alpha Centauri system, the nearest star system to Earth at a distance of just over 4 light-years, a spaceship lifts off and heads toward Earth. Must everyone agree that the spaceship started its journey before I woke up? From the point of view of causality, the issue depends critically upon whether information can travel infinitely fast or not. If information can travel infinitely fast, then the alien spaceship might conceivably be able to fire a laser beam that travels in an instant to the Earth and destroys my alarm clock. The result is that I oversleep and miss breakfast. Missing breakfast might be the least worrying issue given this particular scenario, but we are doing a thought experiment, so let us ignore the emotional consequences of having our alarm clock vaporized by an alien laser and continue. The firing of the spaceship's laser caused me to miss breakfast, and therefore the ordering cannot be swapped without violating our doctrine of the protection of causality. This is easy to see, because if some observer were able to conclude that the spaceship took off after I woke up, then we would have a contradiction, because I cannot oversleep if I have already woken up. We are forced to conclude that if information can travel at arbitrarily high speeds, then it can never be permissible to switch the time ordering of any two events without violating the law of cause and effect. But there is a loophole in our reasoning that permits the time ordering of certain pairs of events to be flipped, but only if they lie outside the 45-degree lines that delineate the curve containing A from the dangerous, potentially causality-violating curve B. Let us imagine the alien laser-exploding alarm clock incident again. But now subject it to a cosmic speed limit. That is to say, we will not allow the laser beam to travel infinitely fast from the spaceship to our alarm clock. Covering ourselves in a thin mist of chalk dust for the last time, we call the laser-firing event B. If the spaceship fired the laser, event B, very shortly before the alarm clock ringing event O, from a very great distance away, then there is no way the spaceship could possibly prevent me from waking up, because the laser beam simply hasn't got enough time to travel from the ship to my clock. This must be the case if the laser beam is constrained to travel at or below some kind of cosmic speed limit. If this is the situation, the events O and B are said to be causally disconnected. We are supposing that B happens just before O, such that it lies in the dangerous region for causality. Different observers will generally disagree on whether B happens before or after O, because their different points of view correspond to moving B around on the hyperbola, which crosses from the future to the past. This is unavoidable, but cause and effect can still be protected if there is absolutely no way that event B can influence event O. In other words, who cares whether B happened in O's past or future, if it makes no difference to anything because B and O cannot influence each other? There are four distinct regions in Minkowski space-time separated from each other by the 45-degree lines. If we are to protect causality, then any event that occurs in either of the would-be causality-violating regions must never be able to send a signal that can possibly reach O. The delineating 45-degree lines are obviously very important. They correspond to events that have a distance in space from O that is equal to the distance in time, CT. How fast must a signal travel from O if it is to influence an event lying exactly on the 45-degree line? Well, if the event is 1 second in O's future, then the signal must travel a distance C multiplied by 1 second. If it's 2 seconds in the future, then it must travel a distance C multiplied by 2 seconds. In other words, it must travel at the speed C. For a signal to travel between B and O, therefore, it must travel faster than the speed C. Conversely, for any events that lie between the 45-degree lines but in the upper and lower wedges, it is possible to communicate between them and the event at O using signals that travel at speeds slower than C. We have finally managed to interpret the speed C. It is the cosmic speed limit. Nothing can travel faster than C, because if it did, it could be used to transmit information that could violate the principle of cause and effect. Notice also that if everyone is to agree on the distance in space-time between any two events, then they must also agree that the cosmic speed limit is C, regardless of how they are moving around in space-time. The speed C, therefore, has an additional interesting property. No matter how two different observers are moving, they must always measure C to be the same. The speed C is beginning to look a lot like another special speed we have encountered in this book, the speed of light. But we haven't proved the connection yet. Our original conjecture is still very much alive. We have managed to build a theory of space and time that looks capable of reproducing the physics we met in the last chapter. Certainly, the existence of a universal speed limit offers promise, especially if we can interpret it as the speed of light. We also have a space-time in which space and time are no longer absolutes. They have been sacrificed in favor of absolute space-time. To convince ourselves that we have constructed a possible description of the world, let's see if we can obtain the slowing down of moving clocks that we met in Chapter 3. Imagine that you are back on the proverbial train, sitting down in a carriage, wearing a wristwatch. For you, it is convenient to measure distances relative to your own position and times using your wristwatch. Your train journey takes 2 hours from station to station. Since you never leave your seat throughout the journey, you have travelled a distance x equals zero. This is the principle we established right at the start of the book. It is not possible to define who is moving and who is standing still, and therefore it is perfectly acceptable for you, seated on a train, to decide that you are not moving. In this case, only time passes. Since your journey takes 2 hours then, from your perspective, you have travelled only in time. In space-time, therefore, you have travelled distance S, given by S equals CT, where T equals 2 hours, because the distance in space, as measured by you, is x equals zero. That is all straightforward. Now consider your journey from the standpoint of your friend, who is not on the train, but who instead is sitting on the ground somewhere. It does not matter where he actually is, just that he is at rest relative to the earth, while you are whizzing by on the train. Your friend would prefer to measure times using his own wristwatch, and distances relative to himself. To simplify things a little bit, let us suppose your train journey is on a perfectly straight track. If you travel for 2 hours at a speed of V equals 100 miles per hour, then your friend notes that, at the end of the journey, you have traveled a distance capital X equals V capital T. We are using capital letters when we talk about distances or times measured by your friend, in order to distinguish them from the corresponding quantities measured by you, i.e. x equals zero and t equals 2 hours. So, according to your friend, you have travelled a space-time distance s given by s squared equals c squared capital T squared minus v squared capital T squared. Here is the crucial part of the whole argument. You must both agree on the space-time distance of your journey. According to your measurements, you did not move, x equals zero, and your journey took 2 hours, t equals 2 hours, while your friend says that you have travelled a distance of V, capital T, where V equals 100 miles per hour, and your journey takes a time, capital T. Well, we are obliged to equate the corresponding distances in space-time, and so c squared t squared equals c squared capital T squared minus v squared capital T squared. This formula can be jiggled around to give us capital T equals ct divided by the square root of c squared minus v squared. So, although your wristwatch registers that your journey lasted for 2 hours, according to your friend, your journey lasted a little longer. The enhancement factor is equal to c divided by the square root of c squared minus v squared, which equals 1 divided by the square root of 1 minus v squared divided by c squared, which is exactly what we got in the last chapter, but only if we interpret c as the speed of light. Are you beginning to feel the Ionian enchantment? We have deduced the same formula that emerged from thinking about light clocks and triangles in the previous chapter. Then we were motivated to think about light clocks because Maxwell's brilliant synthesis of the experimental results of Faraday and others strongly suggested that the speed of light should be the same for all observers. This conclusion was supported by the experimental work of Michelson and Morley and taken at face value by Einstein. In this chapter, we arrived at exactly the same conclusion, but with no reference to history or experiment. We didn't even need to give light a special role. Instead, we introduced space-time and, as a result, insisted that there should exist the notion of an invariant distance between events. On top of that, we demanded that cause and effect be respected. We then constructed the simplest possible distance measure and, remarkably, arrived at the same answer as Einstein. This reasoning is perhaps one of the most beautiful examples of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the physical sciences. Thales would be so enchanted that he would already be reclining in a bath of ass's milk, having been scrubbed by eunuchs. For his concubines to enter his bathroom carrying wine and figs, all we have to do is establish that C must be the speed of light, using an argument that is entirely independent of the historical reasoning we encountered in the last chapter. That climax will arrive in the next chapter. For now, we can take a rest from the maths, leave Thales poised in anticipation, and revel in the fact that we have succeeded in uncovering a whole new way of thinking about Einstein's theory. Space-time really does seem to work. The notion of a unified space and time makes sense, just as Minkowski said. How are we to picture space-time? Real space-time is four-dimensional, but the four-dimensional nature poses a stumbling block to our imagination, because human brains cannot directly picture objects in higher than three dimensions. In addition, the fact that time makes up one of the dimensions just sounds plain weird. A picture that might help make it all a little less mystical is to imagine a motorcycle roaming over an undulating countryside. Roads crisscross the landscape, allowing our motorcyclist to wander this way and that. Space-time is rather like the rolling countryside. The analogue of our motorcyclist travelling due north might be an object moving only in the time direction through space-time. In other words, the object would be stationary in space. Of course, statements like stationary in space are subjective, and so it is to be understood that the identification of due north with the time direction implies a particular point of view. But that is okay. We just need to bear it in mind. Now, the roads crisscrossing the space-time landscape are all restricted to lie within a bearing of 45 degrees of north. Roads due east and west are disallowed because to travel along them, our space-time motorcyclist would have to exceed the cosmic speed limit through space. Think of it this way. If the motorcyclist could travel due east, then he could go as far as he wanted in the easterly direction without any time passing at all, because he would not travel any distance up the northerly time direction. This would correspond to an infinite speed through space. He would get from A to B instantaneously. The roads have therefore been built so that the motorcyclist cannot travel too fast in an easterly or westerly direction. The analogy can be pushed even further. We will very soon show that everything moves over space-time at the same speed. It is just as if our motorcyclist has a device that fixes the throttle on his bike so that he always travels at the same speed over the space-time landscape. We do need to be a little bit careful here, for when we talk about a speed in space-time, it is not the same as a speed through space. A speed through space can be anything provided it does not exceed the cosmic speed limit. For example, our motorcyclist might take a road close to a bearing of northeast, and in doing so he would be pushing as close to the cosmic speed limit as he could. In contrast, a road bearing close to due north would not lead to much movement east or west, and consequently, a journey that is well within the speed limit. The statement that everything moves at the same speed through space-time sounds rather profound and perhaps a little baffling. It means that as you sit listening to this book, you are whizzing over the space-time landscape at exactly the same speed as everything else in the universe. Viewed like that, motion through space is a shadow of a more universal motion through space-time. In a very real sense, as we will now show, you are exactly like the motorcyclist with the fixed throttle. You are moving over the space-time landscape with your throttle fixed open as you listen to this book. Because you are sitting still, your journey is entirely up the northerly time road. If you glance at your watch, you'll see the distance in time ticking by. This is a very strange-sounding claim. So let's go through it carefully. Why does everything move at the same speed through space-time? Consider our motorcyclist again, and imagine 1 second passes according to the watch on his wrist. In that time, he will have travelled through space-time by a certain distance. But everyone must agree on how far that distance is, because distances in space-time are universal and not a matter for debate. That means we can ask the motorcyclist how far he thinks he has travelled over the space-time landscape, and the answer he gives will be the right answer. Now the motorcyclist can choose to calculate distances in space-time relative to himself, and from this point of view, he has not moved in space. It is just like the person sitting on the airplane in Chapter 1 who doesn't stray from her airplane seat and who therefore states that she has not moved. She may have moved relative to someone else, for example, someone standing on the ground watching the plane fly by, but that is not the point. So from our motorcyclist's point of view, he has not moved in space, and yet 1 second in time has passed. He can therefore use the space-time distance equation s squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared with x equals 0, because he hasn't moved in space, and t equals 1 second to figure out how far in space-time he has actually travelled. The answer is a distance equal to c multiplied by 1 second. So the motorcyclist tells us that he is travelling a distance of c multiplied by 1 second for every second that passes on his watch. And that is just another way of saying that his speed through space-time is equal to c. If you have been following closely, then you might object that the passage of 1 second was measured on the motorcyclist's wristwatch and that a different amount of time will pass according to someone else who is moving relative to the motorcyclist. That is true enough, but there is something special about the motorcyclist's watch because the motorcyclist does not move relative to himself, a trivial statement. We are therefore free to put x equals 0 in the distance equation, and so the time that passes on his wristwatch is a direct way to measure the space-time distance, s. This is a nice result. The time that passes on the motorcyclist's watch is equal to the space-time distance travelled divided by c. In a sense, his watch is a device for measuring distances in space-time. Since both the space-time distance and c are agreed upon by everyone, it follows that the motorcyclist has unwittingly used his watch to measure something that everyone can agree upon. The space-time speed c that he deduces is therefore also a quantity that everyone can agree upon. So the speed through space-time is a universal upon which everyone agrees. This newfound way of thinking about how things move through space-time can help us get a different handle on why moving clocks run slow. In this space-time way of thinking, a moving clock uses up some of its fixed quota of space-time speed because of its motion through space, and that leaves less for its motion through time. In other words, a moving clock doesn't move so fast through time as a stationary one, which is just another way of saying that it ticks more slowly. In contrast, a clock sitting at rest whizzes along in the time direction at the speed c with no motion through space. It therefore ticks along as fast as is possible. Armed with space-time, we are ready to contemplate one of the wonderful puzzles of special relativity, the twins paradox. Earlier in the book, we showed that Einstein's theory allows us to contemplate the possibility of travelling to distant places in the universe. Speeding within a whisker of the speed of light, we imagine journeying off to the Andromeda Galaxy within a human lifetime, regardless of the fact that it takes light nearly 3 million years to make the journey. There is a paradox lurking here that we previously glossed over. Imagine twins, one of whom trains to be an astronaut and heads off on humanity's first mission to Andromeda, leaving her twin back home on Earth. The astronaut twin is moving at high speed relative to the Earth, and consequently, her life slows down relative to her twin on Earth. But we have just spent a significant fraction of this book arguing that there is no such thing as absolute motion. In other words, the answer to the question, who is doing the moving, is whoever you want. Anybody and everybody is free to decide that they are standing still and the other guy is whizzing around the universe at high speed relative to them. And so it is for the astronaut twin, who is free to say that she is standing perfectly still in her space rocket, watching the Earth fly away at high speed. For her, it is therefore the earthbound twin who ages more slowly. Who is right? Can it really be that each of the twins ages more slowly relative to the other? Well, it has to be like that. That is what the theory says. There is no paradox yet, because any problems you might be having in believing that each twin observes the other to be aging more slowly are not real problems. They are due to the fact that you are clinging to the idea of universal time. But time is not universal. That much we have learned, and that means there is no contradiction at all. Now comes the apparent paradox. What happens if the astronaut twin returns back to Earth sometime in the future and meets up with her Earth-bound twin? Obviously, they cannot both be younger than the other. What is going on? Is one of them actually older than the other? If so, who? The answer can be found in our understanding of space-time. Let's imagine the path through space-time taken by the twins as measured using clocks and rulers at rest relative to the Earth. The Earth-bound twin stays on the Earth, and consequently her path snakes along the time axis. In other words, almost all of her allocated speed through space-time is expended travelling through time. Her astronaut twin, on the other hand, heads off at close to light speed. Returning to the motorcyclist analogy, that means she charges off in a northeasterly direction, using up as much of her space-time speed as she can to push through space at close to the cosmic speed limit. At some point, however, she needs to turn around and come back to the Earth. We shall suppose that she heads back again at close to light speed, but this time in a northwesterly direction. Obviously, the twins take different paths through space-time, even though they started and finished at the same point. Now, just like distances in space, the length of two different paths in space-time can be different. To reiterate, although everyone must agree on the length of any particular path through space-time, the lengths of different paths need not be the same. This is really no different from saying that the distance from Chamonix to Courmayeur depends on whether you went through the Mont Blanc tunnel or hiked over the Alps. Of course, walking over a mountain means you travel a longer distance than tunneling through it. In our discussion of the motorcyclist speeding over the space-time landscape, we established that the time measured on the motorcyclist's wristwatch provides a direct way to measure the space-time distance he travelled. We just need to multiply the elapsed time by c to get the space-time distance. We can turn this statement on its head and say that once we know the space-time distance travelled by each of the twins, then we can figure out the time that passes according to each. That is, we can think of each twin as a voyager through space-time with their wristwatches measuring the space-time distance that they travel. Now comes the key idea. Consider again the formula for distances in space-time. S squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared. The space-time distance is biggest if we can follow a path that has x equals zero. Any other path must be shorter, because we have to subtract the always positive x squared contribution. But the Earth-bound twin snakes along the time direction with x close to zero, so her path must be the longest possible path. Actually, that is just another way of saying what we already know, that the Earth-bound twin is travelling as fast as possible through time, and so it is she who ages the most. Our explanation so far has been presented from the viewpoint of the Earth-bound twin. To fully satisfy ourselves that there is no paradox, we should see how things look from the viewpoint of the astronaut twin. For her, the Earth-bound twin is the one doing the travelling while she snakes along her own time axis. It looks like the paradox is back again. Since the astronaut twin is at rest relative to her spaceship, it seems that she should speed maximally through time and hence age the most. But there is a very subtle point here. The distance equation does not apply if we set out to use the astronaut twins' clocks and rulers to measure distances and times. More precisely, it fails when the astronaut twin undergoes the acceleration that turns the spaceship around. Why does it fail? The arguments we presented when we figured it out seemed pretty watertight. But if one uses an accelerating system of clocks and rulers to make measurements, as the astronaut twin must, then the assumption that space-time is unchanging and the same everywhere that we use to write down the distance equation is wrong. Over the time of the acceleration, the astronaut twin will be pushed back into her seat, in much the same way as you are pushed back into your seat when you press the accelerator pedal on a car. For a start, that immediately picks out a special direction in space, the direction of the acceleration. The existence of that force must be accounted for in the distance equation, and that is where the loophole resides. It is a little too complicated for us to go into the mathematical details, but the upshot is that when the spaceship fires its rockets to turn around, the Earthbound twin ages rapidly relative to the astronaut twin, and that more than makes up for the fact that she ages more slowly during the non-accelerating phases of the expedition. There is no paradox. We can't resist quoting some numbers, because the effect can be startling. Space travel is most comfortable for those on board the spaceship if the rockets are firing in order to sustain an acceleration equal to 1G. That means that the space travelers feel their own weight inside the rocket. So let's imagine a journey of 10 years at that acceleration, followed by 10 more years decelerating at the same rate, at which point we turn the spaceship around and head back to Earth, accelerating for 10 more years and decelerating for a further 10 before finally arriving back. In total, the travellers on board the spaceship will have been journeying for a total of 40 years. The question is, how many years have passed on Earth? We'll just quote the result because the mathematics is, only a little, beyond the level of this book. The result is that a breathtaking 59,000 years will have passed on Earth. This has been a remarkable journey, and we hope the listener has followed us into the world of space-time. We are now ready to head directly to E equals mc squared. Armed with space-time and our invariant definition of distance, we ask a simple but very important question. Are there other invariant quantities that also describe the properties of real objects in the real world? Of course, distances aren't the only things that are important. Objects have mass. They can be hard or soft, hot or cold, solid, liquid or gas. Since all objects live in space-time, is it possible to describe everything about the world in an invariant way? We will discover in the next chapter that it is, and the consequences are profound, for this is the road that leads directly to E equals mc squared.